The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Horst Schultz. Horst is a founder, chairman, and CEO of the Capella Hotel Group and co-founder and former chief operating officer of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company. Upon co-founding the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company, Horst single-handedly set the business operation and service standards that made the Ritz-Carlton brand globally elite and world famous. Under his leadership, Ritz-Carlton, a multi-billion dollar international enterprise, was awarded the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award twice. In 2002, Horst founded a second company, the Capella Hotel Group, raising the bar set at the Ritz-Carlton even higher to pioneer the first ultra-luxury guest experience. He has a new book. It's called Excellence Wins, a no-nonsense guide to becoming the best in a world of compromise. Horst Schultz, welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you. I have to say right away, if you don't mind, there were a lot of good people involved creating Ritz-Carlton besides me.
All right. I'm just reading from a bio, so someone was really, really good to you.
So, I want to say, wow, there were a lot of great people there, I promise you.
I know, and your book's about that, right? So one of the things that I loved about it was that you constantly remind us that the business world is not really any different than the actual world, and we're not doing ourselves any service in pretending the rules are somehow different in business. And you write at the beginning of the book, quote, "In reality, the people you serve are all the same." And I've always wondered why in business people feel the need to check their humanity at the door, because it feels like that's their greatest asset.
Interesting that you said that. It nearly disturbs me. Why do you have to do that? It's such a disservice to ourselves. Mm-hmm. After all, we spend more of our waking life at work than anywhere else. And it's a time to define yourself. It's a time to enjoy creating excellence rather than just fulfilling a function like the chair in which we're sitting. This, I don't understand why it's not so, but it's also, that's for the individual, but also the companies. Mm-hmm. Why do we hire people to fulfill certain functions? The chair in which we're sitting is fulfilling function. Why don't we select people to join us in our dreams, in our visions, in our commitments, in our future? And so... I don't know why this differentiation existed. I think it goes back a long time when there was much more of a hierarchy world.
Yeah.
But it should be gone by now.
Yeah. And I think I suspect because, I mean, you grew up in the hotel industry. I mean, what's so funny about this is, like, I think most kids dream of being doctors, lawyers, football players. You actually dreamed of working in a hotel, right?
That's correct. That was my dream. I started with, and I don't know why, but for some, and mind you, I grew up in a small village.
Yeah.
There was no hotel. I had never been in a hotel. I never had been in a restaurant at that time. Mind you, that was after the war years in Germany.
Right.
But for some reason, I went to my parents when I was 11, and I said, I want to work in the hotel business. And it kept on insisting on it until they found me a job in a hotel.
And I think it's interesting because I grew up in the theater business, and I think they're similar in some respects because you don't sort of play by the same old business rules. There is a sense of family. There's understanding of roles. There's an ecosystem there that really ties into other people's lives. The other thing that you and I have in common is we were both dishwashers early in our career.
Ah, great. Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's a good place to
start. And you know what? I don't regret a single day of it.
No, it's a great place to start. I mean, I think that you know, there's a certain, I think, insight that you get from starting at that level of the business that then I went on to lead Second City. I was a producer there, and you, of course, led your hotels in a much bigger world than I was in. But still, you can always go back to, like, I know what it's like to be at the lowest rung, and when people were kind to me and offered me mentorship and insights and brotherhood, and that's the world I wanted to create for my employees when I became the boss.
Exactly. That was exactly the thinking, and you know it is. Why wouldn't we do that? Why wouldn't we? Because it, selfishly, I should be doing that. Because when people feel well, they will do a better job.
Yep. Okay. So we have a thing in improvisation. When in my field, you need to be extremely others focused. And you have a line in the book where you say,
"Yeah, well, yes, yeah, you have to." In our case, you have to be customer focused, market focused, and employee focused. Absolutely, it's not what you think. For instance, but the worst thing that you do and a business does is they respond to their own opinion about the product.
Yeah.
You have to be people focused. What does the market? What's the market want from you, really? And create that with people who join you and want to create that. With people who want to do it, creating an environment where people want to do it, your employees want to do it.
And I think the thing that we've learned, certainly from behavioral science in recent years, is you can think you know what the other person wants, but it's likely that you don't really know until you ask a lot of questions and you're listening very deeply.
Very good. Very good. It's one of my preachings. Absolutely. And it's dangerous. And it's also dangerous to listen to your mother-in-law or your buddy who tells you. So that's it. I call that a study of one. It really doesn't work.
Yeah. You have to ask many. You also say that, and I like how you break down this sort of business relationship with the customer. You say the people you serve want three things. They want product and process without defects. They want timeliness, and they want people to be nice to them. And what I love about the book is you say, and being nice to them is greater than the first two combined.
Yes. Customer satisfaction is more impacted by how the relationship between employee or the business and the customer goes than the product itself. You would forgive somebody if they were very nice and the product breaks down and you go back and you accept it very nicely and handle it very nicely, you will forgive them. But if the product works but they were not nice, you will not forgive them. So truly, the caring, the very thing that doesn't cost any money, drives customer satisfaction and eventually customer loyalty more than the product itself.
Yeah.
And we have to accept that. And many people accept that and talk about it, but they don't process it.
Mm-hmm.
But they talk about it, they even advertise their service, but when you get to their business, it is non-existing. Nobody has ever taught it. You have to, once you know it is an expectation, you have to process the issue just like you process creating your product that you sell.
So what I love about this is that almost like a good behavioral scientist, you gave sort of instructions, rules that were habits that allowed people to exhibit and do these behaviors. So one of these, you had a policy where every employee, and this is from the general manager to the busboy, was empowered to spend up to $2,000 to make sure a guest is happy?
Well, yeah, and that created a lot of fireworks, I can assure you, when
bet.
I did that, and it created unbelievable fireworks, but I didn't do it because I just wanted to make a silly decision. We had analyzed very clearly that our average customer was 43 years old, so they had a chance to travel 30 more years. Mm-hmm. Our average business traveler in a given location repeated 4 or 5 times a year, stayed about 2 days, and we could influence them to spend vacations with us in other locations.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew that potentially a customer that whom we face is worth $200,000 lifetime.
Wow.
So wouldn't I make every effort not to lose that customer? So consequently, we came to the point we are going to, and we knew, we started further that the customer, when the customer have an issue, they want to get rid of their frustration with the first person they see. And so if the waiter, if the guest comes down in the morning in the restaurant and says, and the waiter says, I hope you had a good night's stay, and the guest says, no, I didn't, my TV didn't work, there was noise in the street, the waiter is done to own the problem and says, please forgive me. And he is empowered to then say, I buy you breakfast because I feel bad. Mm-hmm. In that moment, the guest will forgive you.
Yeah.
In fact, they will become loyal because they're totally blown away. In fact, they're kind of embarrassed that they even complained.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of saying, I call the manager, that increases the frustration the guest has. So we made a decision. We empower the guest, the employees. And in fact, we empower them up to $2,000. And nobody ever spent $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
They bought a glass of wine and so on, and many things happened. But the guest, but the excitement by the guest when that happened by a given employee was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that you did at one of your hotels was you got rid of checkout requirements. So I wanted you to talk about that because this is a thing every time, and I travel a lot, and I'm always like, do I have to leave at 11? Do I have to leave at noon? And maybe I'm speaking at a conference and I'd really love to stay till 3. And it's always a hassle for me. And I know, you know, and I'm not staying at the Ritz, but I sense if I did, you know, often I wouldn't have that hassle. And you just got rid of them, at least in one of your hotels.
Yeah, well, we got rid of it in Capella Hotels.
Yeah.
Because, frankly, it's an older luxury business. And in our studies, and again, focus on the customer, in our studies, that was one of the great annoyances that the guest had.
Mm-hmm.
When they checked in and the room was not ready, we said, check-in time is at 3 o'clock, and it was 9 o'clock. Or check out, they wanted to check out, and we said, you have to check out at 11 o'clock, and their flight is 6 o'clock. So
yeah.
What did they do? Sit with their suitcase on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
We decided, we analyzed this, can we do better? And we came up with the conclusion, we can. We can in Capella Hotels because they're smaller hotels. We have about 100 rooms. And I don't know if I could do it in a large Ritz-Carlton or any
right.
other where we have 500, 600 rooms. But we know we can do it in a Capella Hotel because there are always some guests that check out early and there are all some guests that stay a little longer. So we make sure that we have staff available very early in the morning
mm-hmm.
rather than do staff to our convenience where all housekeepers start at 8 or 9 o'clock. We have somebody there at 5 o'clock. As soon as somebody checks out, we make the room in case we have an early arrival. And we never had a problem. It works.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
It's just customer focus.
Right, right, exactly. And of course, yeah, you can't do this in every hotel, but this is a problem. If you can't just do it at one hotel, it doesn't mean you can't do it at another.
That's right.
You were the only person who could evict a guest at any Ritz-Carlton hotel, right? You made
yeah,
that rule?
Yeah.
All right. And you have a story in the book, and I'd love you to tell it about you were challenged. There was a very challenging customer that a manager called you about.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Mr. Miller, I mean, that was not his name.
Mm-hmm.
The manager called me and said, Horst, I know we should not evict the guest, but in this case, it's so extreme. He's here for 10 days already, comes to my office every morning, complains nonstop, sits there half an hour. Everything we do is wrong in his mind. And not only that, he pinched the ladies that work in the club lounge. He is on the club lounge. Oh, wow. And so I said, here's what he do. He double locked the room. But he has to understand we're here to take care of the guest. Even in this case,
mm-hmm.
you make a reservation at a hotel, you double lock the room. When he comes back, he said, well, we want to serve you right. We want you to be happy. We were unable, so we're going to try another way to make you happy. We have a reservation at a hotel. We have a limousine waiting for you to take you there. And we evict you. And of course, you will find me. And in this case, they find you. You know, and they're sure enough, you found me. When I answered the telephone, I knew he was there because there was immediate screaming. I'm going to owe your company. I'm going to sue you. I'm going to own you. I'm going to, and so on. Well, when he was through, and I said, Mr. Miller, you have to understand, though, when you sue me, I show up in the courtroom with the three ladies that you pinched.
Mm-hmm.
They will be there. And of course, he never sued me.
Right.
The crazy thing is, about 8 months later, something like that, a number of months later, I get a call from another hotel, And the gentleman said, you know, Horst, I know we cannot evict him, but there's a guest here. He's here for a couple of weeks. He's complaining every morning. He comes in there, complains about everything. Not only that, he pinched the ladies in the club lounge. He said, aha, Mr. Miller is your guest. He said, how do you know? Well, here's what you do. And when Mr. Miller arrived and the room was double locked, and the general manager said, well, Mr. Miller, we are here to make you happy. We couldn't. He said, not again. So, yeah. Well, you know, we learned in our studies, we showed that over 96% of the guests that complain, they just want to get rid of their frustration. There's nothing. There's over 96%. And over 3%. After that, they have a reason to complain, and there should be remedies made. Mm-hmm. Something should be done. We should not charge for the room or whatever. Only less than 1% we call, frankly, the jerk factor.
Yeah.
Those are people that like to complain and like to get something. But you can, if I would delegate that one, then every complaint would be pushed into the jerk factor as category, and we couldn't have that, you know.
Yeah.
So that's why I said that's the one thing where I make the decision, period. I'm not delegating that.
That's right. I remember this when I was running the box office at Second City, and box office people would get in fights with customers over stupid stuff. And I remember saying to them, I figured this out. I'm like, it's not your job to protect the company. We're going to be fine. Your job is to make that other person happy. And, you write, there's a whole section here on dealing with complainers. And I love how you talk about the need not to joke about it, that you have to own it, that you don't say they or them, you say I, you ask for forgiveness. And the big one, too, don't parade your expertise. I think that's really interesting because it's so easy to fall back on that, well, this happened because of this, this, and that, all which may be true.
Exactly. In a way, you give a message that you're dumb, you don't understand. That's not your business to do that. It's just, please forgive me. I'm here to help you and here to correct it. And I feel bad about it.
Yeah, that's so interesting. There's another thing, and this I was talking to Richard Thaler, who's the Nobel Prize winning economist at the University of Chicago, and he had been hired by some sports franchises to examine, you know, how they did their business. And one of the things that he realized after going to a number of games was that they would do these giveaways, right? So you would enter the baseball stadium. If you were the first 15,000, you were given this gift. And then he got the gift, and he held on to it during the game, and it was kind of weird, and he had to put it on the ground, and it got dirty. And then he realized, he went to them afterwards and said, you know, you'd be a lot better giving these people the gift when they leave, because that's when they want the gift. And you talk about that, where it's like, give a good goodbye. The last thing you say to the customer is hugely important.
Well, in fact, you know, the whole process, if you will, the whole transaction of caring for a customer, serving a customer, is it starts with a great welcome. Mm-hmm. And telling them that instant when you make contact, we care for you. And with your eyes, the way you say hello, the way you look, respect them. Respecting welcome. It continues with complying to the needs of the guest's wishes to their benefit. Meaning, I take care of you the way you want to. I'm trying to help you to be sure that I'm serving you. And it ends with a fond farewell. Mm-hmm. Thank you for allowing us to serve you. We were glad that you were here. That's the time of transaction. There are three steps in that transaction. It starts, and then it goes on with complying to their needs and wishes. And it goes in a fond farewell. Thank you for being here. I mean, we should be glad. We should thank every customer, every guest, every patient, whoever it is. Thank you for choosing us. Because of you, we have a job. Because of you, we have a business. Because of you, we may have a career. Everything.
And I think you do, this is how we open the conversation, which is, you know, people seem afraid to use the word love. I don't understand why. It's essential to our, you know, who we are as human beings, that we crave relationship, that we crave purpose. And when you give that to people in any setting, right, whether it's a hospital setting, yes, or a business setting or a theater or wherever, that's what breathes life into us. It is why we are here on this planet. And what's so clear is that by embracing that within a luxury brand, right, I think the lesson here is it doesn't just need to be that. It doesn't just have to be the luxury
brand. You said it. I mean, and I'm pushing that pretty strong in the book. This whole issue of knowing that human beings need to belong and need to have purpose. Mm. Why for employees? Why would we just put them to work rather than offering them to have purpose for the objective of the company, be part, joining and be part? And consequently, I have employees that feel like they belong, and that's what which I need too. And consequently, I have employees who want to do the job and not just have to be controlled to do the job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I want to talk to you a bit about your theories and ideas around leadership. And one of the things that you say in the book is that you need to basically lead yourself before leading others. And I want you to unpack that a bit for us. What do you mean by that?
Well, I have to know where I want to go, what I want to be. I have to make a decision about that. Mm-hmm. And that's an ongoing thing. There has to be a decision. For example, a huge amount of employees come to work unhappy with their job.
Yeah.
Now, clearly, that has to do with the leadership, but it has to do with the individual, too. I can make the decision, lead myself to enjoy my job no matter what. I can make all kind of decisions in my life. I mean, I gave an example. I'm married for 40 years. I have friends. Speak to them and say, why are you getting divorced? They say, well, we don't feel like it. And so, wait a minute. It's not, you have to lead yourself. You can't have feelings lead you. You lead yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still in love with my wife. That's my decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I work on it. Mind you, I work on it.
Yeah.
But that's my decision. And so I have to be the leader of myself and my future and my life. I have to go to work and know that I'm defining myself at work. Again, there is 8 hours of my waking life there. Why wouldn't I make the decision, no matter what, I will define myself as excellence there? So those are leadership decisions that leaders should make overall for themselves and for their people, but an individual also should make for themselves.
I saw this quote the other day, and I'm paraphrasing, but it said, true freedom is knowing you're in control of your own mindset. So that's very powerful, because it's like you have the power to approach this any way you want to. And that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. And you talk about this in the book in terms of, you know, health issues that you know, you confronted in terms of just, you know, changes in the business world. But, you know, if you have the sort of servant mindset first, where you know you're there to serve others, you have a real opportunity to make it through all those difficulties, because it's not just you against the world, right? It's you in service of all the world, and then they bring that back to you.
Correct. I mean, you speak out of my heart there. There's no question about, once you have a leadership role over people, you have to question yourself. It's not just controlling that they do the job, but you now have a role very much impacting their life.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be aware of that and conscious of that, and say, what am I doing? That doesn't mean the misunderstanding should not come in here. That means you compromise. You don't. In the contrary, if you compromise, you're teaching the wrong thing. You don't compromise on the objective of the company. As long as if you set that objective of the company to which you invite everybody to take part of and join in, you have to be sure, first of all, that objective is good for all concerned. For the organization, of course. For the investor, of course. But also for the customer. Also for the employee and for society. Once I know that, I have to create an environment where I can accomplish it. That means create an environment where people enjoy doing it and they join me. But I also, once I know that, cannot compromise anymore. Because if I compromise and go second class or forgive the absolutely wrong stuff that's being done, in that moment, I'm going against everybody, against every employee, against every investor and every guest. I can't do that anymore. And that is an understanding that leadership has to have. But it starts with questioning yourself. Yeah. Is the objective of this organization good for all concerned? Once the answer is yes, you pretty much know the direction that you have what to do.
Mm. Speaking of compromise and not compromise, my job for many years was negotiating the union contract between the Second City Theater and its actors. You have a really interesting chapter, which I did not expect to go this way, about your work with the unions over the years, and in particular, a union in Pittsburgh.
Wow. Was that an experience? In fact, before I went to Pittsburgh, I was hired me to be for my first general manager job in Pittsburgh. In fact, somebody called me from another hotel company and said, we would never go to Pittsburgh again with the hotel. It's the worst. It's terrible, the union, and so on. And sure enough, the experience was fascinating. The first day I'm there, I'm sitting in my office, my new office, my new general manager job, and my secretary comes in, the union is coming. The union. Well, so let them come. That was, we inherited the union, was a unionized hotel. I knew it. And they sit down. One guy turns the back to me. He and the other sit around, and he's the one who talked. Ask him this, tell him this. Mm-hmm. It was comical in a way. I said, what is this? And he finally asked me, a car blown up. And I said, no. Mm-hmm. And he turned around this one and said, I meant with somebody in it. Mm-hmm. In other words, he threatened to have me blown up in a car.
Yeah.
The first day.
Mm-hmm.
That was the relationship. I can tell you, and it went on, and went several times on strike. But the first time they struck me, soon after they struck me, they had several times, it was in the winter, it was cold. So immediately, we rushed out and served the employees that were picketing, and they were nearly all picketing. We served hot chocolate, we served sweet rolls that we had from the mall, we served stuff, we put stuff outside. And of course, the TV stations come, and they ask me, why are you doing that? He said, no, they're still our employees. Mm-hmm. They're still nice ladies and gentlemen. We care for them. The fact that there's some misunderstanding doesn't change the fact that we respect them. That was all over the TV news. But, you know, after 2 years, there was a great respect I had from the union, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Many things happened in between. It was partially very sad, upsetting, hurtful at the moment, but in a way also comical.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you had a good understanding. You weren't at odds, I think, in particular, of what you wanted. What everyone wants to be respected. Everyone wants to be paid fairly. You don't have any problem with that. But they're so used to having that relationship be adversarial. And
that's right. When the union bosses came, they said, our people. They refer to them as our people.
Yeah.
But I also saw, I have to say, I don't have that piece in the book. I was also one of the first 2-3 days I was there when a doorman in a uniform said, hey, come here. He told me, hey, come here. I'm the new general manager. I said, yes. He said, if you play ball with us, you will be okay.
Hmm.
He has a doorman telling me that. And I was really annoyed, but I looked at him. And the uniform had several small holes in it.
Yeah.
Here, we management give the employee a uniform with holes in it. What can he expect of me? What can he think of me as the company?
Right.
So I looked at that and said, wait a minute. Yeah, they have a reason to look at us as they and them. Mm-hmm. And it was... that doorman, after 2 years later, when he saw me, he clicked his heels and said, good morning, Mr. Schulze. But in the same time, we created a huge amount of business in the hotel, an extremely successful hotel with very happy employees. But you can see even those employees who were totally negative about management, about everything, became exceptional that came fine with the guest, and it works wrong. As long as you patiently work it through it, you cannot go down with a sledgehammer with a baseball bat. Yeah. I made it very clear to my management staff. We take 3 steps forward, go 2.5 back, but we gained 0.5 step. Yeah. Slowly but surely. And we did. We won it.
That's great. The way we always end these podcasts is we ask our guest for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, you can't improvise well by saying no, and you can't stop at yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
Well, maybe, yeah. It's an interesting story. Maybe I can tell that when I was with Hyatt. I was a vice president at Hyatt, over 65 hotels, food and beverage operations. Mm-hmm. I had golden handcuff. I had everything I ever wanted working. When I got a call from people in Atlanta that said, we have 2 hotels in construction. We want to build a new company, a new brand. Mm-hmm. And that was an absolute no. Why would I leave a company with 65 hotels and with golden handcuffs, a great company with great people and a great fun in a city that I loved? And I said no first. But they said at the same time, you could basically operationally do your thing. We are investors and developers and so on. And after a couple of discussions, I came home and they called again, and I went on the telephone with the absolute decision to tell them, do not call me anymore. It is all, I'm not coming to Atlanta, period. Mm-hmm. When they said, let me just point it out to you one more time. You can put your own style in here, your own situation. And I started right there. I started dreaming what I would do. I said, could I go top end? Yes. And anybody with good sense would have said no. And I had planned to say no. I had planned to say, please, look, but don't bother me anymore. But I said yes. Mm-hmm. And then a few weeks later, I was sitting in the car, driving out of Chicago, by the headquarters of Hyatt, with tears in my eyes, mm-hmm. while actually crying.
Yeah.
Because I left, and I went to Atlanta, and I questioned my own sanity. So did everybody else. And 19 years later, I left, which had become the finest hotel company in the world. So it was a very emotional thing, leaving this fine hotel company Hyatt and moving to Atlanta and starting something new. But it was driven by a dream in the moment. And anybody that had a brain would have said no. But my emotion was stronger than my common sense, and I said yes.
That's great. The book is called Excellence Wins, A No-Nonsense Guide to Becoming the Best in a World of Compromise. Horst Schultz, thank you for coming on the show.
Enjoyed it very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.